When Stephen got out of the car, he was approached by three young Al-Qaeda members who had been waiting for him. We understood now that they had been following him. They knew where we lived. And I think maybe he had caught on to this too at some point. They tried to kidnap him, but Stephen was a large man. He was 6'2" and just a strong man. But these young men were early 20s, very small in comparison to stature. So they tried to get him into the car, and he was resistant. He was unaware, we think, that they did have a gun on him. And so the one that did have the gun pulled the gun out and shot him 3 times. And immediately, Stephen was in the presence of the Lord.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to Rural Mission. If you're joining us for the first time, great to have you with us. In this podcast, we want to take you on a journey into places and communities around the world where the good news of Jesus is not known. We want to show you what God is up to, how his kingdom is expanding and growing, even in the most unlikely places. I'm Matt, your host, and today we have an incredible story to share with you from the wife of modern-day martyr Stephen Foreman. My guest is Emily Foreman, Stephen's wife, and author of the book We Died Before We Came Here. We'll be discussing Stephen's murder by Al-Qaeda terrorists, God's amazing grace for her and her kids following that traumatic incident, and the ongoing prison ministry that Emily's involved with in West Africa. This is such a powerful story.
Well, it's a real joy for me to have Emily with us today. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Matt. It's great to be with you.
Emily is someone who's worked many, many years in Northwest Africa. Yeah, just a few years ago, she wrote a book called We Died Before We Came Here. And we're going to be talking about the themes that she covers in that book and just hearing some of her story, which is very powerful. And I can't wait to get into it. So tell me a little bit about how you first got interested in global missions and crossing cultures.
Okay, sure. Well, I was privileged to be born into a family of believers, Christians, that took their faith seriously, not perfect Christians by any means. We had our family issues like any other, but really blessed that the Lord did put me in a family that took faith seriously. And so I grew up going to church in a little eastern town in Tennessee, the U.S. And yeah, I loved the Lord. I was so excited to be a Christian, to be a child of God. I understood that concept. It wasn't until I was about 13 or 14 that I really had a bit of a revelation about my purpose in life. And it was when a missionary, doc, who I guess was from our town, came and shared at our church about his ministry in East Africa. And this was the first exposure I had in like face-to-face with someone who had actually worked with people in Africa and saw firsthand the need, not only the physical need, but especially the spiritual need. And that just really rocked my world. And at that moment, my little 13-year-old plans to have the perfect American dream was really shaken. And I just did not see things the same anymore. I actually felt very different from others because I was just heartbroken by what I saw and went on to be a rebellious teenager. You know, I made mistakes, nothing entirely life-altering, thankfully, but went on to live for myself for a while, I guess you could say. And when I was 19, I was coming back around to the Lord and really feeling conviction and feeling unsettled because I just knew that I had something in my life I was created for. And, you know, the purposes he had ordained even before I was born. And I was in pursuit of that. And as the Lord would have it, I met my husband, Stephen. We were working together and he was a bit older. He was about 5 years older than me, very mature even for his age at that time. And I was so just impressed. I fell in love with his love for the Lord more than anything in the beginning. And eventually, of course, we fell in love. We were married. He warned me up front, you know, before we even got serious in our relationship, that he felt like he knew for sure that God had called him to do ministry overseas, to be a missionary, to reach people who need the gospel. And he basically said, and go to hard places because all the easy places were taken.
Right. Yeah. And he gave you a book as well, didn't he? Pretty early on in your...
He did. So on our first date, I believe it was, he loaned me a book that had changed his life. and encouraged me to read it. And that book was Fox's Book of Martyrs. So I read that book and it was so impactful. I can barely describe what it did to my heart and my mind. I felt like I had to submit to the Lord all over again. Mm. It made me wonder, am I really, really, really submitted to the Lord? But it really inspired me. And I could see at that moment, made me understand so much more Stephen's commitment to the Lord and his submission and his passion for the Lord and to reach the lost. So it also made me have to stop and think, okay, it's possible I may marry this man who's willing to give his life for Christ. And so, yeah, that took a bit of time. You know, we talked together about it. We prayed together. And shortly after, we didn't date very long and we were married. And within 5 years, we were living in Northwest Africa in a difficult place, just like he predicted. And we had 4 children at that point. We had gone and done our ministry training, our missions training through an organization called Youth with a Mission, a wonderful organization that really finds many, many open doors, even in the hardest places. And that's how the Lord chose to send us to this area of Africa.
Well, yeah, I don't know if many young believers come across that book these days, but yeah, it's so powerful, isn't it? I remember reading it at college too. So, what happened next then? You're now living as a family in Northwest Africa in a pretty tough place. Were you in an urban context?
We were in an urban context in the capital, but still very, at this point, underdeveloped. Mm. There were parts of the city that had running water, electricity, but because of migration, the city was just exploding population-wise. And there, at one point, I believe it was maybe 60% of the entire population of the country lived in the capital during certain parts of the year until date harvesting season. And then they would go back out to their villages, back into the interior. And the population would reduce in the city, but just it keeps growing. Yeah. But it's really interesting because we loved that strategic part of it. I mean, it's not like God to be so strategic. It wants to reach everyone in all the tribes, right? All the languages. And it's kind of difficult in a desert country where they're so sparse and so spread out. But he was bringing them to the city. They were sending their children to the city to go to school or to go to university. And so essentially we were reaching the whole country by being in the capital city.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's it. That's one of the important factors of the world these days, isn't it? Just growing urbanization and the connection to all the rural areas. So what were you doing there? Were you teaching yourselves or doing some other kind of work?
When we were coming into the country, there was already a non-governmental organization that was established, very small, very limited in its scope. But it was officially established there by a Brazilian lady and she was leaving. And so Stephen, his training was in business anyway. So for him, it was just simple just to go in and fill the void there. He became the director of that organization. And then the organization just ended up growing from there. We were able to expand and reach other areas, other demographics in the city. Our project work was more along the lines of relief and development. And it started in the prison system with the women's prison. So we were doing training in the prison, helping provide nutrition, helping provide all kinds of training, whether it's literacy or health and nutrition and that kind of thing. And then also skills. So we were teaching some limited vocational skills in the prison. But our goal ultimately was to open a training center outside of prison. So our goal was to not just reach the people and serve the people while they were incarcerated, but our goal was to be able to have connection with them and contact outside of prison. And obviously in a developing country like that with the worldview that they have, reintegration, rehabilitation, those things are just they're non-existent. And so we wanted to provide something for that, but also to be able to have follow up with these people, build relationship and, you know, to really be able to share the love of God in a context other than the prison. So we opened a training center and provided all kinds of vocational training, literacy, computer classes, sewing, even business classes. Stephen's favorite part of the project work was to be able to give microcredit loans to little cooperatives, but to be able to give them as he would say, a hand up, not a hand out, so that they could develop a small business, whether it was like a little fruit stand or a little clothing making business. And that was really one of our favorite things, was to be able to do that because it gave us opportunity to visit them.
That's brilliant. I love that. If I remember rightly, in the early pages of your book, you had a moment with your kids in the women's prison where you felt pretty challenged and overwhelmed at the beginning. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Our first time there, when we had visited the country on outreach, probably about a year before we ended up moving there. And we went there for several weeks to do ministry. And for us, the girls on the team, our part of the ministry was to go into the women's prison and teach things, you know, even do aerobics, just do things like that to engage the women and love on them. Our first entrance, though, our first exposure was going into this just dilapidated house and courtyard. And there were just a lot of male guards, you know, around with very stoic faces, angry looking faces. And then women, and the women were not in cells necessarily, but they had rooms in this house that they had to sleep in. So they had freedom sometimes to roam around the courtyard, which was nice, very small, very dirty courtyard, but they came out to greet us and were so excited. And that's one of the lovely things about this culture, is they celebrate. They have so much joy, even in the midst of suffering and even in the midst of deep, deep need for basic things of life. So they were dancing and singing and clapping, and just, it was so amazing. And then I was like, oh, great, you know, I can do this. But the guards wanted them to calm down. So the guards came out abruptly, trying to get the ladies to calm down and go back into the house. And they pull out their whips and start whipping the ladies because they're not listening. And I have my two little girls with me, and I was shocked. So I knew that it was really traumatic for them as well. And it was at that moment, I'm just pushing them behind me, trying to help them not see this happening. And my heart's racing. I'm having a near panic attack, thinking, God, what have I gotten myself into? What are we doing here? You know, I just wanted to turn around and run, but I couldn't. The gate was already locked. And here we are. But that was my initial exposure to the women's prison. But it did turn out to be much more calm. And we had a wonderful time with the ladies, and we developed friendships, and just it really helped us. I guess it really helped the scripture, you know, is it Matthew 25? I believe where, you know, the sheep and the goats are separated. And one of the things that he said, the reason the sheep are the sheep, is that he was in prison and they came to him. And so that's what we did. And it just really was so easy to just be heartbroken and love those women. And there weren't just women, there were children. The women who had small children, they were in prison with their mothers. And so, yeah, it was quite an experience.
Gosh. And yeah, give us an idea of, I don't know, just other parts of daily life, living in a city like that. What were some of the other challenges? What were some of the other frustrations, perhaps, that went alongside with the joys of serving the Lord there, or being on team, or interacting with, you know, wonderful local people?
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges at first. You know, it was about becoming just adapted physically, mentally, emotionally to a different culture. Not knowing the local language just yet. We had studied French before we went. So that helped us get around. It helped us in the marketplace and in businesses, but the poor don't typically speak much French. And so our biggest challenge initially was trying to learn language, which Stephen did tremendously. He really dove into the language and developed friendships. And for me, it was a little more challenging just because I had four small children at home, and I'm trying to homeschool these children and trying to figure out, how do I do any of it? How do I even cook a meal in this? I don't even know how to, you know, I had never used, this sounds so first world, but I had never even used a gas stovetop in my life before that. And I'm like, how do you even light this thing?
Yeah.
And it was not even like the typical you would find in the West. You know, you have your big can of gas and you have to hook it up. And
yeah,
Yeah, all of those things.
Yes, and those things are dangerous, aren't they, as well? If you get it wrong, you know, you do not want to drop that, or there's some leak going on. I remember same in Pakistan, trying to learn how to change the gas bottle yourself instead of having just piped gas coming into the house like we have here in England. It's, yeah, huge challenges of basic living. And I can't imagine how you're doing that with four young kids at the same time. I mean, my wife and I took our oldest daughter out when she was 3 months old, and that was hard enough. But having four, gosh, credit to you.
You know, as challenging as it was, the joys were there as well. And we learned really quickly that our children, though it made life more complex, trying to live there and learn how to live there with our children, actually made ministry so much easier, because in this culture, they love children. You know, Muslims say, and especially in the more conservative countries, the more children, the merrier. Like, it's a blessing. And so for our neighbors, for those that we interacted with, they were amazed that we had four children. They had this thought in their mind that, oh man, Americans, they only have one child maybe and a dog. And they're too caught up in their careers and themselves to care about family, you know. Well, here we are with four children. This is the other funny thing. The divorce rate there is high as well. So it's not uncommon for a woman to have several children by two or three different husbands. And so for us to have been married that whole time and all of our children belong to us, it was really intriguing for them. And so we found ourselves like living in a fishbowl. People were very curious, very fascinated to see this, you know, Western family coming, trying to live there, trying to figure out life. But the children just opened so many doors. And we would go and visit people. If we didn't have the children with us, they would almost make us leave. So really, it was definitely an asset for us to be there as a family. Challenging, but definitely an asset.
That's really cool. Yes, I do want to fast forward because, yeah, it's so good. You're talking about sharing your lives and the love of Christ and getting into people's homes genuinely as friends and showing hospitality. But also, you know, one of the ways that we declare the glory of God in the nations is that sort of incarnational ministry, going, being willing to give up things and people that we're close to in our home countries, and to settle and to just be there and to suffer alongside them, perhaps, or to suffer different things. It might be because we have a different background. Can you speak into some of that?
Certainly. Yeah. And I think that really ties in with hospitality too. You know, it's just having an open door. It's living life with them. And coming from the West, where we were really all about handing out tracts and just making sure there's radio programs that people can have access to, giving out Jesus films, all of these things are really important and very useful for ministry. But I think in a Muslim context, or even any third world, second world context, it doesn't work the same. And yes, God has used those and we used those there, in fact. But the most powerful thing is living life, like you said, living life with Him, living next door to them, like dropping everything and going next door when you heard their child is sick or there's an emergency, and just rubbing shoulders with them. It bridges a gap and it builds trust and it builds rapport and really just paves the way.
And they get to see you when you're sick or when the electricity goes out, it's gone out for you too. And there's no water, or you're struggling with some other government situation. And so, yeah, you're there to help them in their suffering, but they're there to help you in your struggles. And that's so powerful, that two-way dynamic, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And that took some relationship building, I think, to help them feel so comfortable that they knew that I actually would ask for their help, or we really can work together and solve problems when it comes to those things that you mentioned. And I remember one year there was a coup d'etat, and it was scary. You know, living in the capital, not terribly far from the presidential palace, which was under attack, you know, and shots are being heard all over the place. And it was scary. Nobody saw it coming. And it was in the middle of the night. And I remember wakened, of course, and we weren't sure how close we were to the danger. Neither did our neighbors. And so we all walked to the roof of our homes, and wasn't just us, it was all our neighbors too, you know, and we're talking and we're sharing the fear and we're comforting one another and just keeping each other informed. And I think for them to see how we responded in that way, you know, with not overwhelming fear, but really trying to take care of each other and just living life with people, they do see more of the glory of the Lord because they see it's not about the circumstance or the trials or the difficult circumstances. I think that God's glory shines most. It's in our response to those things. And so living with these people, they saw it on a natural level. And yeah, our power was out for a long time. You know, we had nothing, even cell phone service, and just to be able to go next door and in our community, you know, and really encourage one another. So, and showing them that we actually do have a faith in our God and we're praying, which brings me to another point. Another thing that we learned early on was that praying for them is so powerful. And we offer still to this day, we offer so much to pray for people if they're having a challenge or a difficulty or needing a job or whatever. It's so easy to just say, oh, can I pray for you about that? And they'll, without hesitation, 99% of the time in my experience, they say, yes, please. And I always pray in Jesus' name and they don't have any problem with it. So yeah, but again, that opportunity presents itself when you're living in the context, when you're living and sharing.
I mean, the thread that goes through all these different things is humility, really, because there's a humility in stepping out of our comfort and heading over to a country like that. That sense of obedience, yes, to Christ, but we lose a lot of ourselves. We go back to being a kid. We don't know how to speak the language. We don't know how to cook food on this oven or whatever it is. So that's the humility at one level. Then there's the humility of, well, can I even ask help? And I want to help. I want to be a help to my neighbors, but asking for help is another level of humility. And then you're talking about prayer now, and that's so true because we don't have all the answers. We want to help, but we can't. We can't provide for everyone in the neighborhood. We can't meet every challenge or heal everyone who's sick. So we just have to say, you know what? We need to turn to God and let's do that right now by praying. Please, can I pray for you? All of those things are saying, I'm nothing special. I'm no white savior. I'm no, you know, special person just because I come from a wealthier country. It's just we're human together and we need to find the savior. We need to find the answers. And I may be able to show you something that I found that you haven't seen yet. And that's so powerful, isn't it? And so beautiful. Emily, oh, I really want to dig into more around daily life and living there. But I do also want to come on to the major tragedy that happened earlier in your time out there. And that was the death of Stephen. So could you tell us how that went down? And yeah, what was that like for you as a young mom and a wife, you know, losing the fathers, your children and your own husband?
Sure. And I'll try to summarize it. There's so many details and so many aspects to this part of my experience that I still am scratching my head over just God's faithfulness and his presence and his sovereignty. So yes, we had been living there about 7 years and we really felt like we were part of the country. We had learned the language, Stephen, far better than I. We had close friends. We even had been adopted sort of into a local family and were given local names. And we just felt so much at home there. And we were seeing fruit. But about 6 years into our time there, the North African branch of Al-Qaeda had started wreaking havoc in that area of the world. And we realized that. And we also realized, wow, we're in a really vulnerable situation because the country we're in is still struggling in development, especially in terms of security and their military. And how do you patrol a desert anyway, right, with military? And so the danger started becoming more real and a little closer to our context. And by 6 years in, they made it in very close to the capital city, had already killed a number of local military. And at that point, they actually had killed several French tourists as well. And this was a little too close to home, maybe 2 hours, 3 hours from the capital where we were living. And at that point, a lot of expats were leaving. The danger was becoming far too real. And most of the French in the country left. And there's quite an exodus, actually. There were not a ton of Christian workers there, but those that were, you know, depending on their organization that sent them there, they were being pulled, you know, for mandatory sabbatical, or they just chose to take that or chose to retire early or whatever to escape really the risk that was increasing every day. thankfully, again, with YWAM, we have good leadership, but we also have a lot of autonomy.
Yeah, it's similar to us. Actually. Yeah, we're field-led, field-governed. So no one can really pull the plug except the team leader on the ground. And yeah, I mean, this is very similar to us. Well, for me, arriving in Pakistan 2002, 9/11 had happened the previous fall, autumn, and yeah, a lot of people left around that kind of time for all sorts of different reasons. And I had to wrestle with the theology of that. And okay, there's biblical precedent for fleeing at the right time, but then there's also biblical precedent to stay and stick it out if the Lord's calling you to that and giving you grace for that. So you guys decided to stay.
Yeah. And we were not at all critical of any other person that chose to leave or to leave temporarily or whatever. We really didn't have any ill feelings or ill thoughts because, like you're saying, I mean, only the Lord knows, right? And it's between them and the Lord. So we trusted that God was doing his thing and accomplishing his will in the midst of this. But we felt, and I would say Stephen, obviously on a much more profound level, felt a sense of urgency more than anything. And we were, again, we were sensing and seeing like a move of the Spirit and a move among the locals. We were seeing root, you know, and we were in such a good place. And then all of a sudden, you know, this happens. So we were praying and we prayed a lot together. And Stephen, of course, if I had any concern and I asked, no, let's please just go away for a while, he would have absolutely done that and honored that. But really, as we prayed together, it was really just a sense of the Spirit that we were supposed to stay. We had already counted the cost before we went, and we submitted in the beginning and said, we're going to trust you, whatever comes, you know. And so we just had to recommit to that. It was a daily thing, right? To recommit to that level of submission, we decided to stay. And it was really interesting, several of the local believers who were being discipled by those other workers who had to leave were coming to us now. It's like, oh, so you're not leaving? You're not going to leave us? You know, and they were so happy to see that we had chosen to stay. And it wasn't just us. It was really us and the frontiers, I would say, and a few others, I'm sure. So we just continued, you know. And the other thing about this culture is the average person, the locals, the general population were very, very peaceful people. And they wanted nothing to do with the terrorism either. Mm. You know, they were not happy with what was happening. And they felt like, no, this is not Islam. No, this is not what Allah has called us to do. So they were very protective of us oftentimes in this context. So we continued to enjoy the peace and, you know, risk. It was up and down for the next couple of years. And it seemed like things were pretty calm for a bit. But then in June, in our seventh year, I noticed Stephen was getting a little bit preoccupied, you know, getting messages or just a sense of, I don't know, restlessness. And we prayed together and he would make comments frequently, like, you know, if anything happens to me here, you know, just make sure you know this and this and this, and these things are in order. And out of just nowhere, he was saying this. And he also spent a lot more time with the Lord in prayer, I noticed, like not just resting and reading his Bible, but like literally pacing the floor and reading and in prayer. And it wasn't that he was feeling anxious at all. He didn't show any anxiety. It actually seemed like he had a deeper sense of peace, if that makes sense. So that's how things were going for a bit, maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks leading up to the day that he arrived at our training center. He was the first one there, and the shops hadn't opened yet, and the oldest mosque in the city that was across the street. He had become very close to the imam. That mosque had already had their early prayers. And so it was just really quiet, except for a butcher who was preparing his meat to sell for the day. And when Stephen got out of the car, he was approached by three young Al-Qaeda members who had been waiting for him. We understand now that they had been following him. They knew where we lived. And I think maybe he had caught on to this too at some point. They tried to kidnap him, but Stephen was a large man. He was 6'2" and just a strong man. But these young men were early 20s, very small in comparison to stature. So they tried to get him into the car. And of he was resistant. He was unaware, we think, that they did have a gun on him. And so the one that did have the gun pulled the gun out and shot him 3 times. And immediately, Stephen was in the presence of the Lord. I was at home at that moment still and homeschooling. And I was just sitting at the table, I think, with my son working on math or something. And I get a knock at the door. And it happened to be one of our team members from a Scandinavian country. Very serious. She had a wonderful sense of humor, but she never really showed a lot of negative emotion. And she was in tears. Like she was nearly sobbing. And I asked, what's wrong? What happened? And so she brings me into the house and we close the door. And she says, something has happened. Stephen has been shot. And her husband, also named Stephen, had been traveling, doing some consulting. And I was worried. I thought, oh, no, your husband. So I'm trying to console her. And she looks at me and says, no, not my Stephen. Your Stephen was shot and he's dead. And of course, my whole system just in shock. I stopped breathing. I'm just in shock. And immediately I'm reasoning in my own mind, okay, it's a mistake. You know, some other person, maybe he was shot, but he can't be dead, you know, so I'm not accepting this in my mind. But then my mind goes immediately to, okay, how am I going to tell my children?
Yeah.
How am I going to tell my in-laws? And I'm still in this thought process when my friend says, we have to get you out of here. You and the children need to come with me. She lived in another part of town, a little more in an inconspicuous area. So we immediately jumped in the car. I had just told the kids at that point, I sat them down and just said, pretty generally, just vaguely, you know, something's happened to your dad and we need to go to her house. So please go grab a change of clothes, grab your stuffed animal or whatever you need that you have. And we're going to go. So we were very, very quick about that.
Yeah.
And on the way to her house, I was completely silent in the car, obviously. And I still had not really even prayed and I hadn't cried. I'm still in shock. But as I was sitting in the front seat of her car and we're on our way, we were passing just areas of the city. And I'm just like, life is so normal for these people. Like, this is the place that we came to live on. And the first prayer that came out of my heart, I would say, I prayed in my mind. I'm just saying, God, please tell me that you're glorified. If you tell me that you're glorified, I know that it was worth it, you know, because that was Stephen's mantra. It's like, whatever we do, however we do it, at the end of the day, we can lay our heads down and feel at peace if we had done everything we could do that day to glorify the Father, even if it meant giving our lives. And so I knew he was willing. And I knew in my heart, God is worthy. And I feel like it really was the voice of the Lord audible in my heart that said, I am glorified today. So it was at that moment, I mean, still hadn't cried, still really not totally embracing the reality. But God's grace was so sufficient for us. His presence. And I have to say, having community with us during this, having fellow believers, locals and expats, the Protiers, for example, they were amazing. It was tragic. It was very hard, but we weren't alone. And yeah. So thank God for them.
I'm sure the toughest part was, just talking to your kids, you know, and just going through that with them over the next few weeks. I'm a father, I can imagine.
Yeah. So we ended up flying back to the States within, I think it was 48 hours. They still had not caught the guys. This is why we had to rush to the other side of town. Our embassy was amazing. They helped so much in that process. And so we were able to, get back to the States. And we were blessed to be able to actually repatriate Stephen's body as well. And so, it was quite a process just seeing my kids and how they responded. Of course, we all respond differently. You know, there's no universal formula to grief. But it was just amazing for me to see how the presence of the Lord was with my kids. I had 3 girls and 1 boy. So my oldest daughter, 15. My son was 13. And then the other 2 girls were 12 and 7.
Yeah, gosh. Thank you for just walking us through that. Very, very tough moment, and then months and months, I'm sure, of processing and grief. You must have been just dealing with so many different types of grief and loss and all of that. For how long did you stay there in the States for that time, for that season?
Yeah, we were here for about a year and a half before we went back for the first time. And so, yeah, the grief was definitely complex. Grieving father, brother, my best friend, my husband, you know, and my ministry. Like I was really at the point I was grieving my purpose and my ministry as I knew it. And moving back to this little Southeast Tennessee town where it's difficult to find Muslims.
And your community there, as kind as your community are back in the States, they can't understand your world. Your whole world has been so different.
I want to mention an event we've got coming up in the UK on Saturday, the 18th of November. It's our Frontiers Neighbours and Nations Day conference in Oxford, where we'll be gathering to worship, to pray, and to connect with you, our friends and supporters. There'll be seminars to encourage and equip you, time for you to meet workers from the field and those preparing to go, a free lunch, and even a live Raw Mission podcast where you can be in the audience. Reserve your place on our website or email booking@frontiers.org.uk.
Was that the end of Northwest Africa for you? Have you been based in the States since then?
I have been based in the States since then. And initially, that first year, even first few years, I would say, I was processing just sort of the tragedy of losing my ministry. I just felt like, wow, that has to have been a chapter that's closed now. Like there's no more opportunity. And I even actually entertained the idea of going back with my four children and trying to just plug back into our projects and ministry, but it just didn't seem realistic. And I didn't really get a clear leading from the Lord to do that. So I really struggled. And I knew for certain that was not the end of Northwest Africa for me. I just had to finally accept that it may be the end of permanent ministry, like living there long term for me.
Yeah.
And I still don't know that that's the case. And who knows? I hope not. But I did believe that I would still have connection. I knew I still could get a ticket. I could still go back. I still had contact with my friends. And thank God for WhatsApp, you know, and the ability to stay in touch. So yeah, that first year and a half, I just was really struggling to try and just pick back up where we left off. And it just wasn't realistic. But we did go back to visit. And that was a difficult trip in many ways. Very bittersweet, actually. And when we arrived, I wasn't really sure what to expect. You know, when we left so abruptly and we had so many friends. And we were told that when we were evacuated to the other house in the city, we weren't allowed to go back to our house. The U.S. Embassy was very adamant about us not going back because there were just crowds of people around our door all the time. And the security was difficult to control at that point. And people really just trying to come and pay their condolences. So I hadn't considered the fact that this was difficult for our friends as well. And they had not been able to find any closure either because they weren't even able to tell us goodbye. And even though I stayed in contact with quite a few of them, it just still wasn't the same. So when we returned, we were just met with a lot of tears. You know, I was happy to be back and I just, you know, I'd processed grief enough. I was just so happy to see my friends and I'm smiling and I'm hugging them and they're sobbing. You know, for them, it's just like painful and painful for me too. But yeah, I think that was a very bittersweet trip. It was very difficult to drive by our old house and, you know, see things, even things that we had owned and used in other workers' homes, you know, because it got distributed. I didn't bring everything back to the States with me. So that was a little hard for me and my children, you know. And so I would say it was a bittersweet trip, but it was all sweet in that the connections were still there. People were just so inspired, heartbroken, but inspired by Stephen.
I was going to ask, what was the impact on maybe the local church there or just your friends, those who hadn't come to faith? What sort of stories were they telling you about how they processed everything that had happened?
Yeah, we had many conversations. Just, I think one of the most impactful things it seemed for those believers and non-believers alike was the fact that we had our family meeting, Stephen's parents and my children and I, we all put out a statement almost immediately after returning to the States, you know, because we just did not want anything put in the media that would be misconstrued or just not communicated correctly. So we immediately just put out a message that was essentially saying, we love the country, we love the people, we will continue to love the country and the people, and that we harbor no hatred towards the men who had killed Stephen, but that we pray for them. And we basically extended forgiveness, but also expressed confidence in the government of the country to actually make sure that this didn't happen again, you know, and that justice would be served. And so people just really were so confused and just intrigued by the fact that we were willing to forgive. And so that conversation came up often during that first time back, and then still to this day, I have conversations with people about
that. Is it a culture? I mean, there are parts of the world where I've lived where there is quite a strong revenge culture, and it's almost your honor is to take action, personal action, because you don't have confidence perhaps in the authorities or the legal system, or you don't have confidence that God will judge one day. And it's just part of natural cycle of things that you must do something to show that this is not okay. And is that the situation where you were based?
Yeah. Absolutely. And they really struggled with the idea that we were forgiving, because in their minds, they thought that meant we were pardoning them. But it gave me an opportunity, still gives us an opportunity, to explain why we forgive and how this forgiveness is not for the perpetrator's sakes. It's actually for our sakes too, you know, so that we don't carry that bitterness. And we can explain that Jesus has a whole different teaching on how to deal with our enemies. And it's given a lot of opportunity to share the teachings of Jesus. And I think they struggle with it because they do express their own bitterness and their own sense of or need for revenge, because they loved Stephen, you know, and they appreciated what he did. And they don't feel like they're at that point. How can you forgive them? They're just dogs. They're not even real Muslims, you know. They just were really struggling. And so I have seen hearts more open because of that dichotomy. And yeah, it's been amazing. It's been amazing to see how the Lord has worked through just that simple obedience. Pray for your enemies. Bless those who curse you.
I was also wondering if you know what happened to the perpetrators. Were they arrested and put in jail? Did you hear much about their story?
Yes, there were three of them. It's not entirely clear if two of them were on the scene and one was just sort of a stakeout person, but two for sure had approached Stephen, and both were trying to get him into the car. Shortly after that, immediately after they shot Stephen, they fled the scene. And so there was a search for them immediately. And about 2 weeks later, the one who actually pulled the trigger strapped himself with explosives and went back to the scene near the mosque, the oldest mosque in the city, again, across the street from our training center, and was planning a suicide bomb attempt. And the police did catch him and shot him. And from my understanding, he was alive. I think he was shot in the hip and the leg, and they left him lying on the ground sort of as a testimony to their intolerance for terrorism and for that type of violence. So he was arrested shortly after. The second man was arrested, and then the third one. So within 2 weeks, they were all three arrested. So they eventually were given their sentences. The one who shot the gun, the main perpetrator, he received the death penalty, which in that country, they haven't really executed anyone since the 60s, as far as I know. So it really basically translated into life in prison. And then the second perpetrator was given 12 years, and then the third one was only given 3 years. And so we ended up filing an appeal to try and get the two lesser sentences increased, we meaning our organization and people who were really local people who were really not happy with the judgment. And eventually the one who shot the gun, I think it made it all the way to the Supreme Court. As far as I know, he doesn't have even any chance of presidential pardon now. And the second one got his sentence increased. And so I think the third guy now is back in prison as well. So it's comforting to see that the government, you know, the people are very anti-terrorist. It's really not what the world thinks, you know. Mm. So that's been great. And just another aspect to the story, you know, I go back twice a year at least, and we like to take medical teams back in one of those trips. And so because a lot of our project work has been in the prison system, that's one of the most medically underserved populations, obviously, in that country. And so the first medical team we hosted was just women. For whatever reason, it's only the women who volunteer most of the time for these types of trips. And so older women, younger women, and we were able to go into all of the prisons in the capital. And there is one prison in the capital that holds the terrorists. And at that point in time, when we took our first medical team over, they had placed the boys from the boys' prison into the prison with the terrorists, which is ridiculous. And it was because the boys' prison had fallen in, was falling apart. So they were trying to find a new location. In the meantime, they put them in the prison with the terrorists. When it came to our turn, well, when it came to the day that we were going to treat the boys at the boys' prison, we had to obviously go to the terrorist prison. And I knew at that point, at least one of the men who had been involved in Stephen's death was there. And my understanding was it was the second guy. It wasn't even the guy who shot the gun, because he was in an undisclosed location far, far in the interior. But unbeknownst to me, he was actually brought into the Capitol for the last hearing, which had happened the year before, and he was still there. So the warden of the prison told our colleague who works with us there, a local brother, that we could come and treat the boys, but we also had to treat the terrorists because we are a humanitarian organization and they are humans too. So my colleague tried to talk us out of going at all, but I just didn't feel a peace in my heart about that. So I agreed with the warden. Yes, they are humans. And yes, we will go. The women of the team were fine with it. And so the agreement was we would see all the boys first and see all the boys, not just the ones that were sick. And the agreement was made. We went, and as I'm standing there translating for one of the nurses, they start clearing out the room. So we were seeing the very last boy, and they cleared out the room and more guards came in. And then I realized they were about to bring in the terrorists. And so they brought in the first terrorist. I don't remember if he was first or second or third, but I had a feeling, a sinking feeling in my heart that this was one of the men. And so I assumed it was the second guy. But then I hear him. He goes to a nurse behind me, or one of the other doctors behind me, and I'm overhearing the conversation, and he's complaining about this pain because he had been shot several years before and had never fully healed. And then I realized at that moment who that was, standing just feet from me, maybe 2 meters from where I was standing. And of course, I'm overcome with just shock and my heart's racing. I had always thought, what would it be like to meet this guy? What would it be like to say, what would I say? You know, what would I do? Yes, I have forgiven him in my heart, but I'm also human and I lost my husband and he's taken my children's father from them. You know, these thoughts are going through my mind. And so I just try to, you know, remain calm and focus on translating for the next person. And so he gets up and walks out because there's nothing they can do for him except forgive him pain medication like paracetamol or something. And a bit later, our colleague comes in and says, the warden needs to meet with you. He wants to talk with you. So I go back to where this little tiny office down the hall, and the warden is just explaining, you know, I'm sure you know that the man who killed your chief is what he called him, your chief, your boss for this organization is here and he would like to get treatment. We just need to know for sure that you have no intentions of retaliation or any harm. And so my colleague asked the warden, do you not know who this lady is? And so the warden says, no, she's one of the doctors, right? And so he says, no, this is the widow of the chief. And so the warden just is shocked and speechless for a moment. And then he just goes into his paying his condolences, saying he never met Stephen, but he had heard all kinds of wonderful things. And it was very sad for our family. And then he said, you know, he's just right outside the door if you want to have a word with him. And so my heart sinks and I'm feeling faint and I just pray really quickly, Lord, help. What do I do? You know? And so I just say, sure, I will talk with him. So I think really the intention of the warden was to make this man look at me and apologize for what he had done. But he comes in the door. He has no idea who I am either. And he greets, you know, the man standing in the room and he, you know, puts his hand over his chest, the greeting without shaking my hand because I'm a woman. And so he says, well, and the warden says, do you know who this lady is? And he looks at me, he says, no, she's a doctor or a nurse or something, you know, and the warden says, tell him who you are. And so I explained that I was the widow of the man, Stephen, that he murdered several years before. And so his demeanor immediately just changed. Like, he wouldn't look at us anymore. He was almost like this ashamed look on his face. And the warden says, well, what do you want to tell her? Do you have anything to say? And he said, well, I really regret that your husband's death. And but then he went into sort of this excuse that he was framed, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is silly because he actually proudly took responsibility in the beginning. He was just trying, that was his effort to get off of death row, basically. So I just said, well, I know that you did not know who Stephen was. And I think if you knew who he was, you would have never been able to do what you did, because he loved your people. And more than that, he loved God. And we follow Jesus, and he followed Jesus and his teachings. And we are taught that we are to love our enemies and pray for them, bless those who curse us. Yeah, I went through, you know, I think it's Luke 6. And so I basically said, you know, we don't have bitterness in our heart. We're free from that. We have the grace of God through Jesus. And I pray for you that you'll find that type of freedom too. And I did tell him, you know, and if you're innocent, God knows. And if you're innocent, I pray that God will let you find your physical freedom. But if you're not, then I'm praying for mercy for your soul and freedom for your soul. And this whole time, he's just hardly speaking at all, you know, and still not making any eye contact with any of us. And in the end, he walked out, he went and got his, you know, his treatment, because we had someone doing acupuncture that didn't add that part to it. But that was what he was hoping to have, is the acupuncture for the pain. And he was afraid of the needles. We were going to retaliate, right? And so back to translating, and I'm just overwhelmed. I have so many emotions, but the atmosphere in that room was so different. Like, actually, another thing I didn't mention is, as we're standing in this little small room and I'm talking to this guy, we see guards' ears sort of peeking around the door, like, and taking turns and walking by and just looking. And the word got out really, really quickly who I was, he was talking to me. And so when I, even in the room, I was really hoping that no one had told, especially the doctor who was doing the acupuncture. And even the others, you know, I just thought, no, we don't need this right now. We need to focus on our mission here. But the atmosphere in the room was entirely different. So as I'm standing there, and then the next terrorist comes in and sits in front of me, and I'm about to translate for him, and I'm asking him, what's your issue? You know, what can we help you with? And he's just not saying anything. He's just got his fist clenched and he's shaking. I couldn't tell if he was angry, or I was actually worried he was going to punch one of us. Mm-hmm. And I ask him again, as kindly as possible, you know, how can we help you? Is there something? Can you tell us what's going on? And he just suddenly buries his head in his arm and starts sobbing uncontrollably. And so I'm just thinking, what's going on here? Like, I mean, the atmosphere was tangibly different, even on the guards' faces, like, different. It was just strange. I think people were just shocked. And so we just let him cry for a bit. And one of our other team members came over, and a male put his hand on his back and tried to console him. But yeah, it was really wild. There were another couple of terrorists as well that were being seen by the other medical team members, and still they were also emotional. And so I don't know what the Lord did that day. Obviously, I don't know what's happened in hearts, and I don't know what's happened since then, but I do know that there was something that happened in my heart when they opened the doors to let us out. I felt like I was truly out of prison, because I was able to see him and tell him face to face that I pray for him and I forgive him.
Yeah. It, in a strange, painful, but amazing way, that was a gift for you then to just help on your journey of letting him go and just dealing with that grief. That's amazing. I mean, it's the kind of stuff that people have written poetry about and books about over the generations, isn't it? You know, meeting your enemies in that kind of personal way. It's just, it's where the rubber hits the road, isn't it? It's all very well to sing and talk and read about these things, but the gospel works. The goodness of Christ, the mercy of Christ, it works in the toughest of environments, the hardest of hearts, the darkest of prison cells, or amongst unreached peoples, wherever. You know, this is exactly the kind of melting of hearts that grace brings. And that's what's so beautiful about your testimony. Thank you so much for just giving us that insight.
It's a humbling experience to see that, like you're saying, to see the hardest of hearts softened, that at least that's what happened. And you're right, it's the gospel. No other religion in the world can offer what Christ offers.
That's right. As we draw this to a close, Emily, do you have any words perhaps for those who are thinking maybe the Lord's calling me to a difficult situation, a challenging environment, just a God's heart for the lost sheep? Do you have any encouragements for those who are just beginning this kind of journey and maybe are a little bit shocked listening to this podcast, just counting the cost? What would be some of your final thoughts to leave with them?
Yeah, it's true that we have only one life to live, right? And I've heard a quote, you know, life is like a coin. You can spend it any way you want, but you can only spend it once. And so for me, and I think for Stephen, I think we came to this realization that, wow, life is really short. And only what's done for Christ, what's done for God, is really the only thing that outlasts us, that really reaches eternity. And so for us, that helped us put the risk into perspective, you know, and just to be able to give everything, knowing that he's sovereign for one thing. And honestly, I feel like risk assessment is, it's elusive. No one can really assess risk anywhere. You know, it's just things like there are obvious risks in some situations. And then sometimes we're tempted to fear because we don't know for sure if there is risk or how much risk. But the thing is, God is still with us. God is still in control. And whatever comes, we can trust that that will be either entirely in his plan or entirely redeemed for his purposes. And so I think it's worth the risk simply because who's it for? It's the creator of the universe. It's our savior. It's the one who took the greatest risk of all to actually make it possible for us to be reconciled to God.
Yeah, thank you. I think what I'm hearing is just the importance of how Jesus told us to count the cost, to keep an eternal perspective, and to trust him, to trust his sovereignty. And I think you're dead right. You know, he is in full control, and somehow he worked everything together for the good. And it won't always feel like that. And often we'll be in the dark. It's a privilege and a gift when he gives us a little bit of insight into some good things that may come out of tragedies, but sometimes we don't see them. And we just have to trust in who he is. Because we have scripture, we can get that bird's eye view and see the whole history of God's interacting with his people. And in the moments, they didn't feel it either. They could not see the point of wandering around that desert for 40 years. Or they felt shame about their part in that. Or, you know, whoever, wherever we go in scripture, you know, in the midst of it, they didn't really get it. And we're given the blessing of God's word, aren't we? So we can step back and think, okay, in my life, I don't really see the answers here, but I do see God and I know what he's like. And I know there is an eternity. And if only for this life we live, we are to be pitied above all men, Paul says, doesn't he? So there won't always be a neat answer to the suffering we face, but there is always a good God. And that's what we just have to hold on to.
Yeah. And there really is joy in the suffering. Just seems paradoxical, but it's not. I mean, there really is joy with the suffering. And one thing that the Lord has really brought to mind recently, you know, we've all memorized Psalm 23, right? The Lord is my shepherd. Well, at the end of it, you know, he prepares a table before me in the presence of my enemies. And that tells me that even when we're called to dangerous places where the risk is high, he's still there and he's still providing not just crumbs to sustain us, but he's actually preparing a banquet. He gives abundant grace. He gives abundance, an abundance of strength and grace when we need it most. And so I think we can move forward even when it feels scary. Even when we feel like we're surrounded by enemies, knowing that we have him with us and sustaining us and providing.
Amen. Yeah, what a good note to end on. Emily, thank you so much for your time. It's been a blessing to me. Thank you for just helping us, you know, walk along some of that journey with you. And I feel I can see some of it and imagine some of it now just because of your storytelling, which is excellent. So thank you. It's a cost to you, I know, reliving those moments. But bless you and bless your ongoing ministry, your connections, your friendship, your love for the people of the world. And may he use you in your community right there in Tennessee, but also whenever you're traveling. Anna, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Matt. Thank you so much. And thank you for doing this and all that you do.
Thanks for being with us today, guys. As we close, I want to offer you a gift. It's a beautiful invitation to come and join in with the mission of God, the transformational, life-giving gospel work that he has set before us. The Lord asks in Isaiah, "Who will go? Whom shall I send?" Could it be you? Might you be willing to lay it all down, to give up everything for the one who gave up everything for you? To join one of our teams in Central Asia, the Gulf, Africa, Asia, the Balkans, or the Caucasus? Or to support some of our work through prayer and finances? If your heart is stirred to respond, do reach out to us. You can contact me on matt@frontiers.org.uk or visit our website, frontiers.org.uk, or you can check out our social media platforms at Frontiers UK. God bless, guys, and do join us next time for some more inspirational and challenging stories.